and this is VOA One The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Dan and I both bring you reports on issues here in the United States. Next, John Russell presents this week's Everyday Grammar lesson. We close the show with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, this school year, some students in the United States have bigger worries than completing all of their homework. Demand has been growing for children's books that deal with traumatic events such as school shootings. Sales of books for young readers on violence, grief, and difficult emotions have increased for 9 straight years. Nearly 6 million copies of such books were sold in 2021. That is more than double the amount sold in 2012. Those numbers come from NPD BookScan, which examines U.S. sales of printed books. Officials say mental health issues, such as anxiety and depression, have risen sharply among young Americans. Educators and other supporters say children's books can play a part in helping young people deal with such issues. Christine Enderl is editorial director at Imagination Press, the children's publishing division of the American Psychology Association. She said it may seem like second nature to try to protect children from tragic news events, but it's proving difficult to avoid big society issues, Enderl said. Kids face these issues and challenges in their day-to-day life, she added. The book I'm Not Scared, I'm Prepared was first published in 2014. In the story, a teacher shows children what to do when a dangerous someone is in their school. The book was reprinted several times to meet demand after the mass shooting at an elementary school in Texas earlier this year. Barnes & Noble is a nationwide bookseller. It said that bookstores around the country see interest in some books rise and fall depending on local and national events. Some newer books deal directly with real-world gun violence. Michelle Gay's 7-year-old daughter, Josephine, was killed in the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. Gay turned to children's books to help her 2 surviving daughters. One picture book she read to them was The Ant Hill Disaster. The story tells about an ant that is afraid of going back to school after it is destroyed. Gay, who co-founded the nonprofit group Safe and Sound Schools, said The Ant Hill Disaster and other books were a source of comfort for her 2 daughters. Experts say parents should make sure that books dealing with trauma have the support of mental health professionals. Arya Sova is a Chicago-based psychologist. He is working with children who attended the July 4th parade outside of Chicago, where 7 people were killed in a mass shooting. He said that a child who asks many questions about a traumatic event, maybe feeling anxious or thinking a lot about it. If it's coming from the kids' need, then books could be a great way for kids to learn and to read together with their parents, and to review it on their own, and to process it at their own speed, Sova said. But bringing up violence when a child is not worried about it could increase their anxiety unnecessarily, Sova added. In her graphic novel, Numb to This, writer Kendra Neely describes the 2015 Umpqua Community College shooting in Oregon, which she survived. She also describes her efforts to heal after the event, even as mass shootings continued to happen around the country. Little Brown Books for Young Readers published Neely's books. Andrea Colvin is the publishing company's editorial director. She said that, at first, she was shocked when Neely suggested the book idea. I had to remember that, yes, this is what our stories are like now, Colvin said. This is what young people have experienced.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has agreed to accept up to 24,000 Venezuelan migrants at U.S. airports. Mexico has also agreed to take back Venezuelans who come to the U.S. illegally by land, the United States and Mexico said Wednesday. The order goes into effect immediately. Venezuelans who walk or swim across the border will be immediately returned to Mexico under a pandemic rule known as Title 42. The rule suspends rights to seek asylum under U.S. and international law in order to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Any Venezuelan who illegally enters Mexico or Panama after Wednesday will also be prevented from coming to the U.S. under the rule. The U.S. offer of parole for up to 24,000 Venezuelans is similar to a program for Ukrainians who fled Russia's invasion. Immigration parole permits migrants to enter the U.S. temporarily. The program's success depends on whether Mexico will take back Venezuelans who enter Mexico illegally, the Department of Homeland Security said. The moves are in answer to a large increase in migration from Venezuela. Venezuela passed Guatemala and Honduras in August to become the second largest nationality arriving at the U.S. border. Alejandro Mayorkas is the Homeland Security Secretary. He said, "Those who attempt to cross the southern border of the United States illegally will be returned to Mexico and will be ineligible for this process in the future. Those who follow the lawful process will have the opportunity to travel safely to the United States and become eligible to work here." Until now, Mexico has agreed to accept migrants expelled under Title 42 only if they are from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, as well as Mexico. The U.S. struggles to expel other nationalities because of costs, poor diplomatic relations, and other reasons. Poor relations with the Venezuelan government have made it very hard to apply Title 42 to Venezuelans. The pandemic rule has been used 2.3 million times since March 2020, but used only 2,453 times on Venezuelans. In August, Venezuelans were stopped 25,349 times at the U.S. southern border. That is a 43% increase from July, and four times the amount from August 2021. An estimated 6.8 million Venezuelans have fled their country since its economic crisis in 2014, mostly to Latin America and Caribbean countries. But the U.S. economy's strength since the pandemic has led Venezuelan migrants to look north. Venezuelans who successfully apply to the new program online must come to the United States through an airport. That is similar to an effort that began in April to admit up to 100,000 Ukrainians fleeing war. Venezuelans, like Ukrainians, must have someone providing financial support in the United States. They also must find a way to reach the United States. There are currently no flights permitted from Venezuela to the U.S. It is also possible that Mexico limits how many Venezuelans it will accept from the United States. Mexico said in its statement that it will temporarily allow some Venezuelan citizens to be returned. The 24,000 spots that the U.S. is offering is less than the number of Venezuelans that crossed the border illegally from Mexico in just the month of August.
Imagine that you want to talk about your family or your friends. Perhaps you want to describe your parents or classmates. What kinds of structures should you use? In today's report, we will explore a point of connection between grammar and relationships, possessive pronouns. You will learn the importance of these pronouns when talking about family, friends, and more. We divide pronouns into different groups: subject pronouns, object pronouns, and possessive pronouns. When we describe relationships, we often use possessive pronouns. Possessive pronouns take several forms and go by different names in English grammar books. You might see terms such as dependent possessive pronoun, possessive determiner, or possessive adjective. The terms suggest the same basic idea. They act like determiners, appear before nouns, and suggest relationships or belonging. Possessive pronouns take different forms depending on if they are used in the first, second, or third person. In the first person, we have the singular form my and the plural form are. So, a boy describing his father might say,
"My father is very kind."
Or a person speaking on behalf of a family might say,
"Our father is very kind."
In the second person, someone describing another person's mother might say,
"Your mother is very kind."
In the third person, we have singular forms his and her, as in,
"His mother is very kind." "Her mother is very kind."
We also have the plural form their, as in,
"Their mother is very kind."
We can put possessive pronouns with the nouns that are important for describing relationships: friend, brother, sister, cousin, boss, and so on. So, you could say, "My friend, your cousin, our boss," and so on. There are other kinds of pronouns that show possession and do not appear before nouns, but we will have to leave those for another program. Let's take some time to work with these ideas. Use the first person singular along with the following terms to make a complete sentence.
"Brother is older than me."
Pause the audio while considering your answer. Here is one possible answer.
"My brother is older than me."
Now use the third person singular to describe a friend.
Friend is very funny.
Pause the audio while considering your answer. Here are two possible answers.
Her friend is very funny.
Or,
his friend is very funny.
Now use the second person singular to describe a boss.
Boss is friendly.
Pause the audio while considering your answer. Here is one possible answer.
Your boss is friendly.
It takes time getting used to first, second, and third person pronouns. But when you develop a strong sense of how to use them, you will find it very easy to describe all kinds of relationships. Unlike some vocabulary words and verb forms, possessive pronouns appear all the time in everyday speaking and in writing. I'm John Russell.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. In 1801, America had a new president, Thomas Jefferson from the state of Virginia. Jefferson had already done much for his country. He wrote the Declaration of Independence in 1776. He served as America's first ambassador to France and the first Secretary of State. Now he would govern the nation. Thomas Jefferson was happy and hopeful as he took office. His new political party, the Republicans, had defeated the older Federalist Party. The Federalists had controlled the cabinet and the Congress during President George Washington's two terms. George Washington was not a Federalist, but America's second president, John Adams, was. Altogether, the Federalists had been in power for 12 years. The Federalists and the Republicans held very different opinions about how to govern the nation. The Federalists feared that Jefferson and his followers would destroy the social order of the new country. And Jefferson's Republican Party feared that the Federalists would put power in the hands of a few elite people.
The fears of neither side were really justified, but it was a remarkable moment because the election of 1800 was extremely partisan, but it was also the first occasion in which power was exchanged from one party to another without any kind of violence or a revolution.
Andrew O'Shaughnessy directs an international center for Jefferson studies at Thomas Jefferson's home called Monticello. He says emotions between the Federalists and the Republicans were still strong when Jefferson took office. But in his inaugural address, the new president extended the hand of peace and friendship to the Federalists. In his words, "We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists." The leader of the Federalist Party, Alexander Hamilton, did not accept Jefferson's offer of friendship. As Jefferson became president, Hamilton made a speech attacking him. Hamilton had decided to continue fighting the Democratic movement in the United States. But Hamilton's opposition did not worry Jefferson. Of course, he said, the top leaders of the Federalists, men like Hamilton, could never be changed. He was more interested in bringing their followers to his side. He was sure he could show even the Federalists that his program was good for all. In fact, Andrew O'Shaughnessy says, Jefferson expected the Federalist Party just to disappear. He says, people in Jefferson's time did not think a two-party system was essential to democracy.
They thought if people acted in a public spirit and put aside their own self-interest, that they would all recognize the common good and act together.
And he says, Jefferson believed his party, the Republicans, represented the true spirit of the American Revolution. In those early days of 1801, Jefferson said, "We can no longer say that there is nothing new under the sun. What we have done in this country is all new. The force of public opinion is new. But the most important and pleasing newness is that we have changed our government without violence. This shows a strength of American character that will give long life to our republic. We have proved that freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and freedom of thought are necessary in a healthy nation. Let men argue with each other. The arguments may become bitter, but the bitterness is just a cloud that passes. And out of the arguments will come the truth." As for the Federalist leaders, they, except for Hamilton, believed Jefferson's friendly words in his inaugural speech showed he would respect their party. George Cabot, the strongest Federalist leader in New England, usually agreed with Hamilton, but now he did not. Cabot said, "I believe that our new president wants to stay out of war. We do not have to worry any longer that he plans to join France against England. He is friendly to us and wants our help. Therefore, I am sure that he will not dismiss any of our people from their government positions." Another Federalist leader, Timothy Pickering, the Secretary of State under President Adams, said, "I am satisfied that Jefferson will not make any important changes in government policy and that he will depend for support more on us Federalists than on the Democrats." During those first few weeks of the new government, the Federalist leaders really believed that Jefferson was afraid of them. They believed that he had surrendered to them and would be destroyed as the leader of the Republican Party. One Federalist wrote, "Soon Jefferson will feel the bite of his dirty Democrats when they attack him." Jefferson soon did hear complaints from Republican leaders who felt he was being too kind to the Federalists. William Giles, a Jeffersonian leader in Virginia, wrote, "Of course, I am very pleased by the president's inaugural speech. The president's program is correct. It agrees with the opinions of the people. But I still think that the president's success will depend on how he carries out his program. Let him offer friendship to the Federalists, but he must not permit friendship to become weakness. His friends believe that the first thing he must do is to clean out the executive branch of the government. He must dismiss from office all men who are enemies of the Republican program." Even James Monroe wrote a strong letter to the president, "Your speech and your program are healthy and good. But there are serious dangers ahead of you. There are two parties in this country, not one. One of these parties, the Federalists, has controlled the government for 12 years and has hurt our nation greatly. Some of these Federalists now speak softly to you and promise their support. But you must remember, too, that there are thousands of good Republicans who have always supported you. If you keep Federalists in office, if you appoint Federalists to office, many of these good Republicans will stop believing in you. Certainly, there is no reason why you should give jobs to men who worked for the Federalist government of John Adams. Certainly, you must throw out the officials of the last government who stole money and sold their services. Do this, and you will give strength to our Republican movement. Please understand me. I am speaking only of high offices. I do not ask that you dismiss small officials because they are Federalists. They have a right to their political beliefs. Let them keep their jobs. This will show that you are a president who can accept different political opinions. As Federalists and Republican leaders kept asking Jefferson for positions in the government, the president was thinking of his cabinet. He quickly decided who would be his Secretary of State and Secretary of the Treasury. James Madison of Virginia, Jefferson's old friend and the father of the Constitution, would be Secretary of State. For Secretary of the Treasury, Jefferson chose Albert Gallatin of Pennsylvania, the brilliant leader of the Republicans in Congress. Gallatin understood economics and finance as well as Alexander Hamilton did. For the War Department, Jefferson turned to General Henry Dearborn of New England. Jefferson's first choice to be Secretary of the Navy was Judge Robert Livingston, the great lawyer from New York. But Judge Livingston rejected this position. Jefferson finally chose Robert Smith of Baltimore, Maryland. The president had already appointed one man from New England to his cabinet, Secretary of War Dearborn. Now he turned to New England for two more appointments. Jefferson knew that the strength of the Federalist Party was greater in New England than in any other part of the country. He believed that there was no better way to move New England away from the Federalist program than to give cabinet positions to men from New England. And so, Jefferson found his Attorney General in Levi Lincoln of Massachusetts. Like Dearborn, Lincoln was a patriot of the American Revolution. He had been a supporter of Jefferson from the beginning. He was famous as a lawyer in Massachusetts, where he was the top leader of the Republican Party. Jefferson turned to New England as well for the Postmaster General. It was not yet a cabinet office, but its importance was growing. The president gave this appointment to Gideon Granger, a lawyer, businessman, and writer. Granger was one of the strong Jeffersonians in the state of Connecticut. Such was Jefferson's cabinet. All strong Republicans, all completely loyal. The Federalists were shocked. Not one member of their party had been appointed.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm